Hello, I'm your reader, Paula Carezzi, and it's time for our birthdays. Brenda Fuller of Waterloo, happy birthday to you. Darcel Boya of Sioux City, we're sending you a big birthday shout out today. Dawn O'Loughlin of Marion, happy birthday to you and many happy returns. Harold Steele of Wayland, it's your birthday. We hope you have a great day. Mark Routabush of Van Meter, we're also sending you a great big birthday shout out today. If today is also your birthday and you didn't hear your name along with Brenda's, Darcel's, Dawn's, Harold's, and Mark's, please give us a call so we can be sure to get your birthday on our list as well. Here's a reminder that our program schedule has changed dramatically so that we can get as much local information to as many listeners as possible. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m., Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m., Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. to noon. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Midweek Shopping Cart will be read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. We will stay with this schedule until further notice. Let's get back to the news by turning to today's USA Today. We'll begin with five things the editors say we need to know this Wednesday, January 27, 2021. First, U.S. records its deadliest month in coronavirus pandemic. January has become the deadliest month of the coronavirus pandemic for the United States after the toll at over 79,000 Tuesday, according to Johns Hopkins University, exceeded December's total by over 1,000. Coronavirus deaths and cases per day in the U.S. dropped markedly over the past couple of weeks, but remain alarmingly high, with just under 3,100 deaths a day on average. That's down from more than 3,350 less than 2 weeks ago. In all, new cases are averaging about 170,000 a day in the U.S. after peaking at almost 250,000 on January 11th. The number of hospitalized COVID-19 patients has fallen to about 110,000 from a high of 132,000 on January 7th. Globally, there are more than 100 million cases reported from COVID-19. Second, regular Biden administration coronavirus briefings to begin. Starting Wednesday, experts in President Joe Biden's administration will host briefings 3 times a week on the state of the coronavirus pandemic outbreak, efforts to control it, and the race to deliver vaccines and therapeutics to end it. The new briefings are meant as an explicit rejection of President Donald Trump's approach to the outbreak. Quote, "We're bringing back the pros to talk about COVID in an unvarnished way," Biden said Tuesday. Quote, "Any questions you have, that's how we'll handle them, because we're letting science speak again," end quote. The briefings also are part of Biden's attempt to rebuild public confidence in institutions, particularly the federal government. The president also announced Tuesday the U.S. has reached an agreement to purchase an additional 200 million coronavirus vaccine doses, a boost that means it will have enough supply to fully vaccinate 300 million Americans by the end of summer or beginning of fall. Third, winter weather sweeps across the nation. After a blockbuster snowstorm blanketed large swaths of the central and northwestern U.S. with, quote, historic, end quote, amounts of snow, a new series of storms on Wednesday could lead to a wintry mess for even more of the nation. According to the U.S. Weather Service, the storm system will move east Wednesday before heading offshore. On its heels comes yet another system that's forecast to barrel into California as a so-called atmospheric river storm, bringing with it the threat of major downpours to drought-stricken land, destructive flows of debris, and a heavy dump of snow. Meanwhile, travel conditions across the country remain hazardous, and local officials are warning residents of power outages, road closures, and facility closures. Quote, "Do not travel unless it's absolutely necessary," said Nebraska State Patrol Colonel John Bolduc, whose agency responded to more than 200 weather-related incidents on Monday. Fourth, MLB Hall of Famer Hank Aaron to be buried in Atlanta. Baseball Hall of Famer Hank Aaron, who battled racial prejudice and hatred on his way to breaking a Major League's career home run record, will be remembered at a private funeral service on Wednesday. Aaron, who died last week at 86, will be buried in Atlanta, Georgia, at historic Southview Cemetery, the city's oldest black cemetery, where he will be interred alongside civil rights leaders such as John Lewis, Julian Bond, and Martin Luther King Jr. The former all-time home run leader, trailblazer, and arguably the greatest hitter of all time, was revered unanimously throughout the game. His signature moment in baseball came on April 8, 1974, when he broke Babe Ruth's home run record. And fifth, lawmakers to grill Biden's pick for UN. Linda Thomas Greenfield may need some of her trademark so-called gumbo diplomacy on Wednesday as she faces lawmakers for her confirmation hearing as President Joe Biden's nominee to be U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. Thomas Greenfield, a black woman who grew up in segregated Louisiana, served as the top U.S. diplomat overseeing African affairs in the Obama administration and is backed by her 35-year career in foreign service. During the hearing, lawmakers are likely to grill her on Biden's most contentious foreign policy priorities, including his push to revive the Iran nuclear agreement and his promise to confront China. And if confirmed, Thomas Greenfield may face lingering skepticism and resentment on the job after the Trump administration's abrasive approach to the institution and its treatment of America's allies. In today's coronavirus updates compiled by Eleanor Aspergren and John Bacon, with more and more students going back to school this week, evidence from the U.S. and other countries indicates schools can operate safely with precautions and that they should open for in-person instruction as soon as possible, researchers from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say. In an article published Tuesday in the Journal of American Medical Association Network, the researchers wrote that wearing masks and maintaining social distance have proven effective at limiting transmission of the coronavirus in schools, but activities like indoor sporting events can promote spread and should be diminished. Quote, "The preponderance of available evidence from the fall school semester has been reassuring," the three researchers wrote. Quote, "There has been little evidence that schools have contributed meaningfully to increased community transmission," end quote. Still, returning college student populations may be at even greater risk than they were in the fall, not to mention their surrounding communities, where research has suggested greater outbreaks in college towns. In the headlines, Eli Lilly announced Tuesday that its monoclonal antibody cocktail cuts hospitalizations by 70% for high-risk COVID-19 patients. Alaska and Kentucky have detected their state's first known cases of the coronavirus variant identified last year in the United Kingdom, officials said Tuesday. The diagnoses raise the total of states reporting cases of the variant to 25. President Joe Biden announced that he will raise the minimum weekly supply of vaccines to states over the next 3 weeks from 8.6 million to 10 million, or by 16%. Biden is further trying to boost America's chances in the fight against the pandemic with a deal in the works to purchase 200 million more doses of COVID-19 vaccine. The global total of coronavirus cases surpassed 100 million on Tuesday, according to the Johns Hopkins University dashboard. The U.S., with a little over 4% of the world's population, has more than 25% of the infections and nearly 20% of the deaths. Stephen Brandenburg, a Wisconsin pharmacist and admitted conspiracy theorist accused of trying to spoil dozens of vials of COVID-19 vaccine, is facing 20 years in prison after he agreed Tuesday to plead guilty in federal court, prosecutors said. The vials contained enough doses to vaccinate more than 500 people. In today's numbers, the U.S. has more than 25.4 million confirmed coronavirus cases and more than 425,000 deaths, according to Johns Hopkins University data. The global totals, more than 100.2 million cases and 2.15 million deaths. About 44.4 million vaccine doses have been distributed in the U.S. and 23.5 million have been administered, according to the CDC. Laura Ungar of Kaiser Health News reports, schools often ignore public health guidelines for in-class learning. Many school districts and states holding in-person classes have ignored recommendations from public health officials or written their own questionable safety rules, creating a tinderbox where COVID-19 can sicken and kill. An analysis of federal and state data found more than 780 complaints covering more than 2,000 public and private K-12 schools. Among the complaints, employees reported sick children coming to school, maskless students and teachers less than 6 feet apart, and administrators minimizing the dangers of the virus and punishing teachers who spoke out. Quote, "The response to the virus has been politicized," said Dr. Shandy John, an expert in pediatric infectious diseases at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Quote, "There's a willingness to ignore data and facts and go with whatever you're hearing from the internet or from political leaders who don't have any scientific knowledge," end quote. Adriana Rodriguez of USA Today reports, "Double masking, quote, just makes common sense," end quote, says Dr. Anthony Fauci. Double masking was in the spotlight last week during President Joe Biden's inauguration, where several high-profile officials and celebrities were photographed wearing two masks. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, says that it's likely more effective to prevent spread. Quote, "So if you have a physical covering with one layer, you put another layer on, it just makes common sense that it likely would be more effective," Fauci told NBC News Today on Monday. Quote, "That's the reason why you see people either double masking or doing a version of an N95, end quote. So does a study published in the peer-reviewed journal Matter in July, which found that wearing two masks could increase protection from the virus particles by 50% up to 75%. It not only added an extra layer of protection, but also made the mask fit snugger around the face, said study author Dr. Loretta Fernandez. Americans' renewed interest in double masking also comes as variants that appear to be more contagious emerge from the UK, South Africa, Brazil, and California. On the front page of today's USA Today is an investigation focusing on the riot at the Capitol. This is written by Daphne Durrett, Aaron Mansfield, and Nick Penzenstadler of USA Today. The investigation is titled, "Capitol Police Stockpiled Riot Gear. Where was it?" Here's an excerpt from that story. A year ago, the U.S. Capitol was the kind of place where a suspicious flicker on a radar screen was all it took for police to lock doors and stop traffic on surrounding streets. Quote, "We've got alerts for anything you can imagine," Capitol Police Chief Stephen Sund told a congressional committee in February, explaining an incident November 26, 2019, that sent parts of the Capitol into a half-hour lockdown while police investigated. "Being ready to take decisive action quickly was crucial," Sund told Congress during budget hearings last year, as he disclosed a 75% increase in threats to the Capitol under President Donald Trump. Sund told congressional leaders that he needed a $54 million budget boost, including $7 million atop an eight-figure materials budget to upgrade equipment and supplies. No one in the hearing objected. Yet 3 weeks ago, when the threats turned into the single largest attack on the main building under the agency's protection, hundreds of officers were sent into the chaos with little, if any, protective gear. Their bare knuckles gripped the tops of lightweight metal barriers that the rioters peeled off and used to beat them. A few officers threw punches, eyes wide behind blue surgical paper masks, the only shield between them and the throng of insurrectionists. Flashes of heroism by the force during the siege added to questions of how Capitol Police could be overrun by a loosely knit mob of far-right extremists, rioters, and hangers-on. The answers will be picked apart by the public, inspectors general, and Congress for years to come, starting with a closed-door House Appropriations briefing Tuesday about what went wrong. Whatever the department's shortfalls, money wasn't one of them. Capitol Police spend as much as the entire Dallas Police Department to protect a 2-square-mile jurisdiction, the Capitol and its perimeter. This year, Sund earmarked $22 million of the department's nearly $516 million budget for equipment. Quote, "They should have had everything they needed to protect the Capitol," Representative Maxine Waters, a Democrat from California, told USA Today. Quote, "Those barricades were so flimsy, it was a horrible scene," end quote. What went wrong? Who's to blame? Ed Baylor watched the Capitol riot with tears in his eyes as outmanned and under-equipped police were overrun and beaten on live television. Baylor led the threat assessment unit for the Capitol Police until he retired in 2005. In his 32-year career there, he commanded everything from the 400-man civil disturbance unit to the horse-mounted officers. After preparing for 8 inaugurations and the Million Man March in 1995, Baylor has doubts that leaders of his former agency could have failed to anticipate the threats leading up to January 6th. The force has spent millions beefing up physical security, he noted, such as reinforced concrete walls and steel fences around the building. Quote, it was police management problems, officer problems, and member of Congress problems, Baylor said. Quote, there are ways to secure the building that could have been done faster and sooner, end quote. Sun resigned in the fallout from this Capitol siege, as did Senate Sergeant-at-Arms Michael Stenger and House Sergeant-at-Arms Paul Irving. Stenger, Irving, and Capitol Architect J. Brett Blanton make up the police board that coordinates protection for major events. Sund, as chief of police, was the fourth non-voting member of the board. At least 17 Capitol Police officers have been suspended while investigators look into how they handled the invasion. Officer Brian Sicknick, aged 42, died the day after rioters bludgeoned him with a fire extinguisher, and 81 officers were injured, according to court records. In her first public statement since taking over the police department this month, Acting Capitol Police Chief Yogananda Pittman apologized Tuesday for the failures. The agency should have done more to protect the Capitol, she said. Pittman said Capitol Police had asked 1,200 officers to be ready for an attack, but only 4 of the platoons were outfitted with riot gear and less lethal ammunitions, less than a quarter of the officers. She expressed the belief that nothing could have prepared them to prevent a protest of that size overrunning the Capitol. The Capitol, even in its layout and design, was made to be open and welcoming to citizens, she said. Quote, I doubt many would have thought it would be necessary to protect it against our own citizens, Pittman said in the statement. Quote, we know the eyes of the country and the world are upon us, she said. Sund did not return several telephone calls from USA Today seeking to understand why the force's advanced equipment was not on wide display January 6th. In interviews with NPR and the Washington Post, Sund said he wanted to send more officers out in riot gear, but Stenger and Irving were concerned about how it would look, a claim that Pittman confirmed Tuesday. They would have needed to agree on a major show of force. Sund said he tried to get military support lined up ahead of time. The Post reported last week that Charles Flynn was one of the top military leaders in the room when the Army rebuffed Sun's request for help as the rioters descended on the Capitol. Flynn's brother, former Trump National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI in 2017. He received a pardon from Trump in November and called for Trump to declare martial law and force a redo of the election. Waters disputed Sun's claims that he tried in vain to get help before the riot. She said when she spoke with him ahead of time, he mentioned only Washington Metropolitan Police as a source of backup. If Sund knew the severity of the coming threats and was unable to get outside help, Waters said, he and the board should have stepped up their own efforts. Barricades should have been stronger, she said, and every single officer on the ground should have been armed with the best protective gear available. Also on the front page of today's USA Today is news of the Senate impeachment trial. The headline is, Early Signs Hint Acquittal, and Bart Janssen of USA Today reports, Trump's words likely to be key evidence at trial. Senators who were sworn in Tuesday for the impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump are grappling with what rules will govern the case as they judge whether he incited a riot at the Capitol that forced them to flee to safety while vandals rummaged through their mahogany desks. As they chart out how the trial will work, Republicans hinted at their final vote. Senator Rand Paul, a Republican from Kentucky, proposed a motion Tuesday to declare the trial unconstitutional because Trump has already left office, but it was rejected on a 55-45 vote. The vote suggested Trump may be acquitted because a two-thirds majority, or at least 67 votes, is needed for conviction, and more than one-third of the chamber voted that the trial is unconstitutional. Quote, we're excited about it, Paul said after the vote. It was one of the few times in Washington where a loss is actually a victory, end quote. Republican Senators Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Mitt Romney of Utah, Ben Sasse of Nebraska, and Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania joined Democrats in killing Paul's motion. Collins said the vote indicated Trump would probably be acquitted. Quote, I do the math, but I think that it's extraordinarily unlikely the president will be convicted, Collins said. The chamber wrestles with a trial that's unusual in a number of ways. It's the first time a president has been impeached twice. It's the first time a president has been tried after leaving office. And senators are witnesses in addition to jurors, as well as the presiding officer. Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, the longest-serving member of the Democratic majority, is presiding over the trial rather than Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts. Roberts presided over Trump's first trial, but the Constitution calls for the Chief Justice to preside only over trials of sitting presidents. The trial is scheduled to resume February 9th after House members who serve as prosecutors, called managers, and Trump's defense team each file written arguments in the case. House Democrats were joined by 10 Republicans to impeach Trump January 13th, charging that he incited the insurrection by repeatedly claiming falsely that he won the election. Trump argued that his speech outside the White House to supporters January 6th was, quote, appropriate, end quote, and that he can't be held responsible for the violence at the Capitol that left 5 dead. Millions watched on national television as a mob supporting Trump smashed windows and doors at the Capitol. The intrusion interrupted the House and Senate and their counting of Electoral College votes that confirmed Joe Biden won the presidential election. The Senate must decide whether to call witnesses or gather other evidence. Potential witnesses include Georgia election officials Trump pressured to overturn the state's results and rioters who entered the building. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat from New York, said he was negotiating the details with Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky. Quote, we'll see what happens, Schumer said. We don't know what the requests are on the other side yet, of the managers or the defense, end quote. The main evidence is likely to come from Trump, his speech exhorting the mob to march to the Capitol because, quote, if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore, end quote. His tweets previewing a, quote, wild, end quote, time, and his inaction as violence unfolded. Quote, I think the principal witness is going to be Trump himself, said Jimmy Garulli, a Notre Dame law professor and former federal prosecutor. The ultimate verdict will be political. In a Senate with 50 Republicans and 50 lawmakers who caucus with Democrats, a vote of 2/3 of the Senate is required to convict. Lawmakers have called it a vote of conscience. Quote, he roused the troops. He urged them on to fight like hell, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat from California, said of Trump. Quote, he sent them on their way to the Capitol. He called upon lawlessness, end quote. Republicans called it pointless to impeach Trump after he left office. Though Trump spoke forcefully, the language was no more harsh than regular political speech, they argued. Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina, said the trial could be conducted in a few days to argue points of law because, quote, the public record is your television screen, end quote. Quote, I don't think he believes he played a role in the defiling of the Capitol, Graham said. I think the argument that the election was stolen was overdone and got people ginned up. I think he's responsible for that. But people's decision to come here and take over the place, that lies with them. End quote. Also on the front page of USA Today, Joey Garrison reports that, quote, unity, end quote, may prove elusive. President Joe Biden entered the White House calling for unity to meet a convergence of crises, telling Americans that, quote, politics doesn't have to be a raging fire, end quote, as he called on both parties to, quote, start afresh, end quote, in his inauguration speech. It was a repudiation of the flame-throwing politics of President Donald Trump 2 weeks after a mob of pro-Trump supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol to try to stop the counting of Biden's election victory. As he leans into messages that won him the election, decency, respect, and working together, Republicans argue Biden's aggressive early agenda doesn't match the talk. How Biden balances a bold policy agenda with a commitment to unify will in part shape his first 100 days in office. Republicans want concessions from the president. The White House and the president's allies have countered, saying unity isn't measured by finding complete agreement in Congress, but instead in civility and working for all Americans, not just speaking to a political base. Quote, navigating this is going to be challenging, said Amy Dacey, executive director at American University's Sign Institute of Policy and Politics. She said unity is, quote, bringing both sides of the table, end quote, not agreeing with the opposition party on everything. Quote, Democrats did win the presidency. They are in control of both the House and the Senate. I would think you will see much more going across the aisle, end quote. Bipartisanship in Congress could become more challenging as Trump's impeachment trial begins in the Senate the week of February 8th. On his first day in office, Biden took unilateral action to undo defining Trump policies, rejoining the Paris Agreement on climate, canceling the permit for the Keystone XL pipeline, and ending Trump's travel ban from several Muslim-majority countries that were popular among conservatives. Other executive orders in Biden's first week pushed liberal causes, such as prohibiting workplace discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity, and revoking some of Trump's immigration policies. The White House wants Congress to quickly pass a $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package, which Republicans, including Utah Senator Mitt Romney, have criticized weeks after it approved a $900 billion package. That proposal is on top of an immigration plan that includes an 8-year pathway to citizenship for nearly 11 million undocumented immigrants. Quote, a radical leftist agenda in a divided country will not help unify our country, Senator Marco Rubio, a Republican from Florida, tweeted Friday. Quote, it will only confirm 75 million Americans' biggest fears about the new administration, end quote. Senator John Cornyn, a Republican from Texas, tweeted, quote, another, quote, unifying move, end quote, by the new administration, end quote, after Biden announced Monday he overturned Trump's ban on transgender troops serving in the military. Gallup polling has found 71% of adults are in favor of allowing transgender people to serve in the military. On Fox News Sunday, Rubio said, quote, unity and ideology are two separate things, acknowledging that there will be disagreement. He said he understands Biden, quote, comes from the left of center, end quote, but the policies the president has embraced, on immigration, for example, are, quote, far left of center ideas, end quote. Quote, he may use the language, the rhetoric, even the demeanor of a centrist, but so far his policies don't seem to represent that, and I think that's an important thing to note as we get into these debates about different issues, Rubio said. In a push for bipartisan dialogue that often was missing in the Trump administration, the White House held a Zoom call Sunday with 16 senators from both sides of the aisle to pitch the administration's COVID-19 relief bill, the American Rescue Plan. Republicans who took part included Romney, Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Rob Portman of Ohio, Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, and Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia. Senators were briefed by three White House officials on the hour and 15-minute Zoom chat. No Republican senators have expressed support for the bill. Pressed about what he means by unity, Biden pointed to ushering in a new tone in Washington, eliminating, quote, the vitriol, end quote, and, quote, ad hominem attacks, end quote, while seeking actions that the majority of Americans want. He said most Americans want the federal government to do more to combat the pandemic. Quote, if you pass a piece of legislation that breaks down on party lines, but it gets passed, it doesn't mean that there wasn't unity. It just means it wasn't bipartisan, Biden said Monday. I prefer these things to be bipartisan because I'm trying to generate some consensus, end quote. He said it, quote, may take some time, end quote. Quote, we're going to argue like hell. I'm confident of that. Believe me, I know. I've been there, Biden said. Quote, but I think we can do it in a way that we can get things done for the American people, end quote. Senator Ron Johnson, a Republican from Wisconsin, was not convinced. Quote, I just wish that his actions matched the words of his inaugural in terms of being unifying and healing, Johnson said Monday. I'm not seeing his initial actions being that, which is disappointing, end quote. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said Republicans aren't looking for, quote, symbolic, end quote, gestures. Quote, they are looking for engagement. They're looking to have a conversation. They're looking to have a dialogue, and that's exactly what he's going to do, end quote. She said seeking bipartisanship on legislation is just one piece of unity. Quote, it also means projecting that he is going to govern for all people and address all of the issues that the American people are facing, she said. If Democrats can't find 60 votes in the Senate for the COVID-19 relief bill, the threshold to override a filibuster, requiring support from 10 Republicans, they could seek to pass the package via budget reconciliation. Under budget reconciliation, only a simple majority is required to pass legislation in the Senate, but bills are subject to certain constraints that would make it more difficult for Democratic priorities, such as a $15 minimum wage, to be included. Psaki said Biden has been, quote, personally engaging, end quote, with Congress members of both parties about the legislation. Quote, reconciliation is a means of getting a bill passed, Psaki said. Quote, that does not mean, regardless of how the bill is passed, the Democrats and Republicans cannot both vote for it, end quote. And it's just over half past the hour, which means it's time for us to turn to the opinion page of today's Des Moines Register. At the top of the page is a Your Turn guest column written by Joe Millard, who has a Ph.D. in education from Iowa State University, plus 40 years of teaching and administration experience in Iowa public and non-public schools. His column today is titled, Education Bills Quickly Reach the Wrong Answers. What is Governor Kim Reynolds' rush to make over Iowa's educational system in the middle of a pandemic? The Iowa legislature and Reynolds appear to be in a panic to overhaul Iowa school systems without input from Iowans. They propose legislation that will create additional charter schools, increase public funding for non-public schools, and mandate how local districts provide instruction to students. Are they taking advantage of the public during these vulnerable times? The governor said in her Condition of the State address that she has heard from parents, students, and teachers about their frustration as how their school districts offer instruction during this pandemic. Nevertheless, she decided what to do without formal input from the public. Legislation should not be based on the flavor of the month requests. Local school board participation should have been part of formulating this legislation. Local school board members are elected representatives who prepare policies and supervise district operations. It is autocratic for a governor and state legislators to bypass local school board authority, the State Board of Education, and citizens of Iowa to assume they know what is best for Iowa. The health of students and school employees was ignored. There should have been speedy action to vaccinate all school employees, make available additional health supplies, provide adequate space in crowded classrooms, and require wearing masks to reduce the spread of COVID-19. Why is there a new desire to develop additional charter schools? If this is a request from Iowa citizens, there should have been public participation and educational organization involvement. The state should analyze research studies done where charter schools exist. State leaders need to determine whether charter schools are successful in teaching academics, educating special needs students, and accepting all students regardless of race, color, or creed. Approving more charter schools should occur only after a complete study of their successes and failures. Why does the legislature desire an increase in funding religious and special interest schools? Have Iowa's governor and legislators lost interest in supporting public education? Transferring public school funds to non-public schools when public schools are underfunded is not only intolerant, but also irresponsible. The governor wants a law passed requiring open enrollment for all students in all school districts. This legislation would permit students who wish to change school districts the opportunity to transfer. Historically, in large school districts where open enrollment allows all students to enroll in neighboring schools, wealthier students open enroll in suburban districts. Because school finances follow where the students attend school, suburban schools gain money while city school funding is decreased. In addition, Reynolds believes transferring students need not wait to participate in interscholastic activities. This is an added bonus, making a transfer more inviting for some students. Why is there a panic by Reynolds and Republican legislators to pass a school's overhaul so swiftly? These school transformation issues may have long-lasting consequences on students, educators, public education, and society at large. Why are Iowa's governmental leaders deliberately keeping Iowa citizens uninformed of possible consequences? Again, this is a Your Turn guest column written by Joe Millard. In today's letters to the editor, Georgie Clevar of Decorah writes, take it from a Catholic school parent. So-called choice bill should fail. Here we go again. Once again, our governor and Republican legislators want to take public tax monies from public schools so that parents can use the money to select a private school or even homeschooling. This type of bill, often called education savings accounts or vouchers, has not made it in past legislative sessions, and I hope it doesn't get passed this session. Don't get me wrong, I am not anti-private schools. I attended Catholic schools, and our daughters received a quality education at the local Catholic school. but private schools should be funded with private funds. In the past year, dedicated school board members, superintendents, and teachers heroically have made decisions about how best to provide public education to students. Our governor thanks them by saying that education savings accounts are needed to save children, quote, trapped in a failing public school, end quote. We need to ask our legislators to increase school aid and not take funds from public schools. We all know that public schools are an essential part of our democracy. Further, the governor wants legislation stating that schools must offer 100% in-person education. What happened to local school boards deciding what is best for their districts? Signed, Georgie Clevar of Decorah. Josh Jorgensen of Dubuque writes, not realistic to return to normal. When it comes to the COVID-19 pandemic, Governor Kim Reynolds continues to prove that she just doesn't get it. In her insistence that Iowa school districts return to fully in-person learning, she echoes the sentiment of all Iowans with her desire to return to a pre-pandemic normal. However, Reynolds seems to forget that our health emergency calls for spacing and social distancing. The governor's insistence on a one-size-fits-all approach fails to recognize the vast differences among Iowa schools. In Dubuque, where students have attended classes using a hybrid model, Hempstead and senior high schools welcome approximately 1,600 and 1,700 students, respectively. Meanwhile, nearby Bellevue has successfully hosted fully in-person learning since August. However, Bellevue schools welcome fewer than 400 students across 1st through 12th grades. Reynolds, long a proponent of school choice, would be well served to support choice in another fashion, allowing for local communities to make decisions on how best to educate their students during these trying times. Signed, Josh Jorgensen of Dubuque. Sue Vandekamp of Nevada writes, Biden shows contempt for workers. In 1789, Marie Antoinette, the Queen of France, was told her subjects had no bread to eat. Her supposed response was, quote, let them eat cake, end quote. Last week, an executive order by President Joe Biden canceled the Keystone Pipeline project and over 11,000 people lost their jobs. Pete Buttigieg, who had been nominated to be transportation secretary, basically shrugged and said they can find new, good-paying union jobs. These actions and words, coming during a pandemic that has caused so much anxiety, heartbreak, and loss of income, are unconscionable. People and businesses are struggling to stay alive, and this is what the new administration deems appropriate? The executive order should be rescinded immediately. Signed, Sue Vandekamp of Nevada. The opinion page of today's Register also includes a Your Turn guest column written by Cindy Axney, the U.S. Representative for the 3rd Congressional District and a resident of West Des Moines. Her column is titled, Healing and Helping America Starts at Kitchen Table. In the past year, America has faced overlapping challenges unlike anything we have seen in a century. Not since the election of 1932 has our nation observed a transfer of power in the midst of such turmoil. But the work ahead for President Joe Biden, my colleagues and I in Congress, and Iowa's policymakers, the work necessary to heal and help our nation, is not too colossal to achieve. Real progress can be made, and it starts at your kitchen table. Whether it's over the day's first cup of coffee or the last bite of reheated dinner after working a double shift, the kitchen table is the primary witness to the concerns of everyday Americans. It feels when plates are empty and bills pile up. It hears when whispers of lost jobs, family, illnesses, and the viruses, and worries about the future. The kitchen table provides us the roadmap to moving our country forward. First and foremost, we must redouble our efforts to meet the greatest challenge still facing our state, taking the threat of COVID-19 off the table. That means drastically improving the vaccine production and distribution efforts and reducing disparities in the hardest-hit communities in rural areas. We must also address the economic damage wrought by this public health crisis. The stock market and rebounding employment rates create a mirage of a healthy economy. But there are Iowans forgotten by these numbers. I've heard from some of the 130,000 Iowans who have left the labor force entirely and thus are ignored by common unemployment figures, often because they've lost access to childcare or have been out of work so long they've stopped looking. I've also heard heartbreaking stories from Iowans who are still struggling to keep food on their tables. in the greatest country in the world, even as Washington Republicans expand tax breaks for 3 martini lunches while balking at nutrition program spending, hundreds of thousands of Iowa families still have children that go hungry. Thousands of Iowa's small businesses are facing the financial pressure to shutter if aid programs don't extend further into the new year. We should destigmatize public health protocols like face masks to ensure that businesses can keep their doors open and patrons safe and support the ones who can't operate in the pandemic. The economic impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic and poorly conceived payroll tax deferrals have put the projected insolvency for Social Security within the next decade. Medicare and Medicaid have been targets of cuts for far too long. We need to shield these programs from cutbacks and ensure that the wealthiest earners pay their fair share to keep benefits available for generations to come. The Kitchen Table also hosts concerns about structural and existential threats to Iowa families. Some politicians may roll their eyes at the words climate crisis, but ask any farmer in southwest Iowa whether they spend time worrying about the growing intensity and unpredictability of storms and droughts. Others may reject the existence of structural racism, but a family who loses a child or a parent because of unnecessary use of force deserves better than closed ranks and no answers. Finally, we must treat the rot of disinformation that continues to erode the foundations of our democracy. If night after night Americans sit down at their tables only to hear on repeat that their elections were stolen and that they should take action, how can we expect to maintain the health of our democratic institutions? We need to enable Americans to identify these falsehoods and hold perpetrators responsible for their disinformation as well as the actions they incite. There is so much work to be done to heal the divisions in our nation, but I'm confident that if we begin by tackling the daily struggles that come across our families' kitchen tables, where families of all political stripes, creeds, classes, and colors begin and end their days, we can rediscover how much we all still have in common. Again, this is the opinion of U.S. Representative Cindy Axne. Let's turn now to the opinion page of today's USA Today. Today's debate focuses on global warming, the view of the editorial board, on COVID-19 and climate. Denialism is deadly. If there were any lingering doubts about the undermining of science as the COVID-19 crisis erupted last year, Dr. Anthony Fauci has horror stories to prove otherwise. In a series of recent interviews, most notably with the New York Times, the nation's leading infectious disease expert revealed how his informed advice for grappling with a growing pandemic was all but dismissed by a White House flirting with denialism. Quote, "We would say things like, this is an outbreak. Infectious diseases run their own course unless one does something to intervene," end quote. Fauci recalled, quote, "President Donald Trump would get up and start talking about, it's going to go away, it's magical, it's going to disappear," end quote. A year and more than 424,000 dead Americans later, grim lessons have been learned about the costs of downplaying research-based measures such as mask wearing, social distancing, and testing. Science is also riding to the rescue in the form of safe and effective vaccines. The same kind of fact-based, science-based approach is also needed to tackle climate change, the other crisis threatening humanity. Levels of heat-trapping carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, produced in large part by the burnings of fossil fuels, are higher than the Earth has seen in at least 800,000 years. Last year tied 2016 as the hottest years on record within the hottest decade ever recorded. Megablazes across the country last year incinerated towns and forests that were made tinder dry for prolonged drought. Warming ocean waters helped transform storms such as Hurricane Sally into slow-moving, water-deluging behemoths. New research this month reveals that fresh water frozen on Antarctica is melting into the oceans at a rate 6 times faster than 40 years ago, a clear sign of warming planet and harbinger of a precipitous sea rise in the decades to come. Although climate change is already a here-and-now problem, scientists say it's possible to slow the rise in global temperatures and mitigate the most catastrophic effects. This will require reducing greenhouse gas emissions and even extracting gases from the air if science can't find a way to do it at scale. President Joe Biden was elected on a platform that included prioritizing the fight against climate change. Among his first actions were rejoining the Paris Climate Accord and rolling back Trump-era deregulation. Today, he's expected to announce a moratorium on new oil and gas leasing on federal land. In the weeks ahead, Biden will seek hundreds of billions of dollars in clean energy investments, including projects such as installing vast numbers of electric vehicle charging stations. We continue to believe that a crucial step should be a refundable national carbon tax, about which Biden is silent, to make renewable sources and carbon capture schemes more competitive with fossil fuels. And, in our view, Biden's quick canceling of the Keystone XL pipeline is a largely symbolic move unlikely to keep oil from being extracted from Canadian oil sands. Nonetheless, with Biden's election, the nation and Congress can begin the crucial and necessary debate over how best to attack this crisis. Denying that the crisis even exists, as Trump did with the coronavirus, and many still do with human-caused climate change, kills debate and ensures nothing is accomplished until it's too late to avert calamity. USA Today also includes an opposing view, written by Nicholas Loris, Deputy Director of the Heritage Foundation's Rowe Institute for Economic Policies, entitled, "We Don't Need a Government-Centric Approach." Climate change is real, and man-made emissions are indeed having an impact. However, many of the subsidies and regulations being proposed are costly and ineffective, benefiting the well-connected rather than the planet. Take President Joe Biden's unexpected moratorium on new oil and gas leases and drilling permits on federal lands. Western and Gulf Coast states, which rely on energy development for their economic life, would suffer. The decision would result in less supply, fewer jobs, and less revenue coming into these states, money used to fund everything from public schools to conservation efforts. Worse, all the economic costs of the moratorium would buy a change in the Earth's temperature that's practically unnoticeable. A climate model developed at the National Center for Atmospheric Research shows that eliminating all fossil fuel production on federal lands would avert 0.08 degrees Celsius of warming by the year 2100. Further, policies that restrict or prohibit natural resource extraction in the United States will not stop or substantially change the global consumption of these resources. Instead, production will shift to places where the standards are not as rigorous, increasing emissions in the process. This administration's recent energy actions represent a broader concern with a government-centric approach. They will result in higher prices and are fraught with unintended consequences. In fact, even if the United States were to achieve a net zero emissions target at the sacrifice of higher energy bills and a weaker economy, the climate benefit would be minimal, as America constitutes a relatively small percentage of global emissions. The Paris Agreement does little to change this, as major emitting developing countries have free rein to emit well into the future without meaningfully changing their behavior. A more effective way for the government to lead is to get out of the way. Reforms should focus on breaking down barriers to innovation, providing timelier permitting for new, cleaner energy products, and reducing trade barriers that stunt the adoption of more efficient technologies. We need economic freedom, not more restrictions. Again, this is the opinion of Nicholas Loris. Today's USA Today opinions also include one written by Dr. Thomas K. Liu, an assistant clinical professor of medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine and an attending physician of hospital medicine at Stanford Healthcare Valley Care. All opinions are his own. His column today is titled, "Don't Give In to COVID Fatigue." After nearly a year of treating very ill hospitalized patients with COVID-19, I received a letter from a patient I had cared for in March. The previously healthy 35-year-old professional had spent a month on the ventilator, and his muscles had atrophied so much that he had lost the ability to walk. 10 months later, he wrote to say he has finally fully recovered and can run miles. I was heartened to hear how far he had come. Unlike my patient, though, as a nation, we are still finding our footing with this pandemic. We have made a great deal of progress in understanding the virus and are now armed with proven therapeutics and vaccines. In many ways, however, the worst aspects of the pandemic have not changed. My hospital wards are still filled with patients struggling to breathe. Intensive care units are full, and after more than 424,000 deaths, we are still fighting the perception that this virus is not lethal. The death toll is on track to pass 500,000 in February, which is impossible to fathom. At nearly 4,000 deaths per day, that's the magnitude of a September 11th attack spread across the nation, per day. spend an afternoon in the hospital, and the numbers start to become entirely believable. Hospitals across the nation have dedicated COVID-19 units, and even then, more space is needed. Every day I go to work, I have a growing census of patients, young and old, who are struggling to breathe, even on incredible amounts of oxygen. Some recover, some are destined for weeks on the ventilator, and some die. Even those who recover are less worse for the wear, with persistent fatigue, post-traumatic stress disorder, and asthma-like conditions. Dwindling ICU beds. Rather than ramp down with the end of 2020, cases and deaths from COVID-19 reached all-time highs. We have easily surpassed the 25 million mark for infected persons. More troubling, we are again entering a phase of dwindling ICU beds, staffing, and resources. Many areas, including large cities like Los Angeles, are in a state of emergency where oxygen has become a precious resource and is rationed only to those with the best chances of survival. Not only is this dangerous to those infected with the coronavirus, but it is also life-threatening to anyone else who becomes sick or injured. Suffering a heart attack or even getting into a car accident becomes that much more hazardous when the healthcare system is strained. Even doctors and nurses are becoming in short supply. After nearly a year of this, healthcare workers are getting tired. Burnout rates are high, with some states unable to find enough nurses. With all the hard work being done, it is incredibly discouraging to see our fellow citizens ignoring our recommendations and realities. More than 8 million people traveled by air in the United States in the last week of 2020, which increased transmission of the coronavirus and led to the spikes of cases we are seeing. This past week, I personally treated several patients who traveled for the holidays and have not been able to return as they and their families suffer from COVID-19. And now California has lifted its curfew and stay-at-home orders, which will tempt many people to resume a more normal routine. I get it. Just as health workers are tired, the public is also fatigued from relentless COVID precautions. But this is not the time to let up. Vaccines are now a reality, and though the national rollout has been chaotic and confusing, the shot will eventually be available to you. When it is, please take it. Precautions are still necessary. The vaccines are safe and tested and provide significant protection from the virus and its new variants. There are mild side effects of fatigue, body aches, and fevers that many experience, especially with the second shot, but they're nothing compared with the actual symptoms of COVID-19. In addition, you will protect the community by reducing your chances of needing hospitalization, which frees up medical resources. This is what will lead to a sustained hashtag flattened curve. Do not give in to COVID fatigue. Continue to wear masks and socially distance. Until most of us are vaccinated, the chances of viral transmission, hospitalization, and death remain high for everyone, not just the vulnerable. Because the vaccines are not 100% and take time to reach peak efficacy, these precautions will still be necessary. The idea that you could go back to a normal life 5 minutes after getting vaccinated is unrealistic and dangerous. More likely, we will see some return to normalcy in the second half of the year. It has been a long road and will continue to be difficult for the time being. But like my patient who learned to walk again, we will recover. We just need to resist COVID fatigue, stay motivated, listen to public health experts, and continue to move forward like my patient did, one step at a time. Again, this is the opinion of Dr. Thomas K. Liu. Returning to the news, the Associated Press reports in today's USA Today, priest who gave exorcisms for voter fraud leaves diocese. A priest who live-streamed exorcisms aimed at rooting out what he, former President Donald Trump, and some Trump supporters have claimed was widespread voting fraud in the presidential election has left a Roman Catholic diocese in Wisconsin. The Diocese of Madison said it and the Reverend John Zulsdorf reached a mutual decision on his departure. Zulsdorf will relocate from the diocese, quote, to pursue other opportunities, the diocese said in a statement earlier this month. Quote, the Bishop of Madison is grateful to the Reverend Zulsdorf for his faithful support of the diocese seminarians and priests, thanks him for his many years of steadfast ministry serving the diocese, and wishes him the best in his future endeavors, the statement said. Zulsdorf did not immediately respond to a phone message and email Tuesday seeking comment. Zulsdorf claimed he had permission from Madison Bishop Donald Hying to conduct the exorcisms. Haing said, however, that he didn't give Zolsdorf permission to conduct exorcism related to, quote, partisan political activity, end quote, but rather approved an exorcism, quote, for alleviation from the scourge of the coronavirus pandemic, end quote. Recordings of Zolsdorf's exorcisms have since been removed from YouTube, the Wisconsin State Journal reported. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops defines an exorcism as, quote, a specific form of prayer that the Church uses against the power of the devil, end quote. Diocese spokesman Brent King described Zolsdorf's role as that of a, quote, freelancer, end quote, and said he was not an employee of the diocese or a parish. Doyle Rice of USA Today reports Alabama tornado leaves one dead and at least 30 hurt. Residents of the northern suburbs of Birmingham, Alabama, were picking up the pieces Tuesday after a devastating tornado ripped through the area the night before, killing a teen huddled in his basement and leaving at least 30 people injured. Several of the teen's family members were critically injured when a tree fell on their Fultondale home and caused the house to collapse. Quote, they were doing what they were supposed to be doing, Fultondale Police Chief D.P. Smith said. The teenager killed was a 14-year-old student in ninth grade, according to Jefferson County Superintendent Walter Gonsolin, adding that other students may have lost their homes, and the high school also sustained severe damage. The tornado left a 10-mile-wide swath of destruction from Fultondale, a Jefferson County city 8 miles north of Birmingham, to Center Point. Much of the area sustained severe damage from a bigger tornado a decade before. A preliminary report from the National Weather Service estimated wind speeds from Monday's tornado were at least 135 miles per hour. Tim Herring said he and his wife Patty had little notice the tornado was coming, so they ran to the bathroom and covered up inside the tub with towels. A couple of minutes later, their life had changed dramatically. Quote, we got out and my wife said, we don't have a roof, he said. I walked in the hallway and said, we ain't got no walls either. I said, we're lucky to be alive, Patty. End quote. Across the street from the Herrings, Jason Williams, his wife, and two teenage daughters rode out the tornado in a basement shelter that sustained some damage. The rest of the house was destroyed, and Williams said it came down on them, trapping the family for about 20 minutes until neighbors came to the rescue. The Williams survived with only bumps and bruises. Quote, other than that, God had his mighty hands on us, he said. And that's it for our second hour of the Register on Iris. We're so glad to have you listening. I'm your reader, Paula Carresi. Coming up next, obituaries from the Des Moines Register.